in the next 5, 10, 15 years, we will see a switch to airspace being primarily unmanned priority, including, you know, aircraft that move people around the world. And at the point that that happens, whoever controls that, that is an enormous opportunity.
What makes an incredible VC? A true partner while you're building your company, or someone that gives you money and then leaves you alone, Angus?
People spend 30, 40% of their time just like manually doing things, manually writing work orders, talking to vendors, you know, pulling data out in CSV format to merge it. You know, it's just an absolute chaos of a process.
There's an Irish drone supply chain startup called Manna. They managed to raise $30 million delivering things like coffees to residential homes. Is this lame or lucrative, Angus?
I would say that's lame.
Profitable business at 15 and then VC-backed, AI-enabled startup. What are some of the misconceptions that you have around drones now that you're at that stage? Hello and welcome to In the Blink of AI, where I talk to the brightest AI startups and innovators each week. I did that from memory this time, guys. 30 episodes and I can do it now. I'm Georgie Healy and this week I am speaking to the incredible Angus Stevens from Aseti. I actually met him last year as part of the AI Accelerator at Google, and I've been impressed ever since. I knew he would be great on the show because he's really not afraid for a spicy take, and he's a deep thinker, so I could kind of hit him with any of the headline news and questions, and knew he would dive right in. We spoke about Angus's very early start as a teenage entrepreneur. We asked the drone king, as I've called him, whether headline drone companies were lame or lucrative, and why unsexy, in inverted commas, AI-enabled industries such as asset management are actually pretty exciting, especially if you're an investor. As always, we share our top AI hacks of the week, and we have our spicy takes to finish. This was a pure joy. Thank you, Angus, for being on the show. Let's dive right in.
You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
Hey, Angus, thank you for joining In the Blink of AI. Before we dive into what you're building now, you're one of the most interesting backgrounds, I will say. And so I do want to dive into that a little bit first. How does it feel to be 24 and interviewed by Forbes? You're not 24 now, but when you were 24.
No, I'm not 24 now and I'm a long way past that. But, you know, you just got to get on with it. You just got to keep doing things. It doesn't matter what happens, I guess. Customers expect things from you and they're the ones that ultimately judge. So, yeah, just got to get on with it. Don't think too much of it.
So you weren't like me and just sharing it with and dropping Forbes magazines into like people's like pathways as they were walking past. Your ego didn't inflate at that time.
Pushing them out of the back of a plane. No, none of that. None of that. We, you know, it's good for exposure, those sort of things, but it doesn't necessarily deliver on what we need to as a business. So got to balance it.
Yeah, there's a very adorable baby Angus photo still on the internet. Forbes 30 under 30, everyone. Check it out. It really speaks to what I find fascinating about your background, which is this passion for drones. I don't know if you'd still call it a passion now, but tell us the story about how you first found drones compelling and, yeah, where that came from.
I've been doing drones half my life now. So I'm 32 and I first read about drones when I was 16 or 15. So it does consume a bit, but I was reading a history textbook about, you know, drones.
As one does.
I was at school.
Okay.
But it was about how drones, you know, had been used through conflict from very sort of early stages. And I knew nothing about that. And so I did a bit of research and, you know, one thing led to another. And I sort of had stitched up 15 or 16 drone distributor agreements from companies across the world. They were very different back then. You know, it's almost 20 years ago. It was a lot used in agriculture and sort of really large fixed wing drones. I could never see someone, you know, flying a drone for fun, basically, which I clearly misread that. But yeah, the industry was very different back then. But it's been a journey. Do I love drones these days? Or I don't know. I love what they can do. You know, and I think more and more it's about enablement and using technology to do things. And that's where, you know, now drones are a fraction of what the sort of product is in its totality in a city. And I think they're an incredible enablement tool for enterprise particularly, but there's so much more, you know, there as well.
You said fixed wing drones. How many different types of drones are they, and what's a fixed wing drone?
The drones sort of largely similar to aircraft fall into two or three categories. So fixed wings like aeroplane style. Rotary wing has like a rotor, like a helicopter basically, and then the multi-rotor.
Oh, I'm familiar with those ones. Yeah.
Like the drone you see people fly in a park, that's multi-rotor.
Yes.
And then there's some hybrid versions of them as well. So there's like VTOL, which might be fixed wing with sort of vertical takeoff capabilities and things. So they largely follow the classes that exist in manned aviation as well. So
the listeners would be so mad if I didn't ask why you'd use one for one case and one for another. Is there any clear-cut reason why you'd use one and not the other?
It sort of all revolves around, you know, what the use case is. So fixed wing, large drone, much like if you fly to Europe, you're not going to fly there on a helicopter.
True.
Usually inefficient. But if you wanted to, fly around a canyon, you do that on a helicopter, not on a Boeing. And so it's a similar thing, agility, there's a trade-off between the things, usually to do with scale, accuracy of data, and those sort of things. The most pervasive drone is definitely multi-rotor. They're tiny, cheap to make, very sort of easy to control, which means they,
That's the ones I see at the park, yeah. My son really wants one. I'm like, you're 5, calm down. But if he starts reading history textbooks, I'll know that he could be Forbes 30 under 30, so maybe I'll get him one. Look, before we dive into more of the AI, of it all, you are my go-to person to ask about the Southern Highlands because you're often there, right? What do tourists get wrong about the Southern Highlands? What should they do when they're there?
There's so much to the Southern Highlands. I think that's the greatest sort of thing about it. There's so many little villages and those sort of things. If anyone wants Southern Highland tips, hit me up. As you know, I'm good for Southern Highland tips, but I can tell you where, good vanilla slice is, where to get the croissants, where to get the coffees, and probably where to go to buy chickens. But that
chickens to eat or chickens to have as pets? There's a distinction there.
Well, I can tell you both, but I would have actually, I was more for ownership of chickens. But
you're like lemon slice, coffee, chicken.
They all were pulling into the same category. I did actually mean live chickens, but I can probably, I actually don't know a good chicken shop down there, but I'm sure there is one. I'll circle up for our next chat.
You're like, I can help you with silky bantams, but if you want to eat one, I've got nothing. Amazing. Look, we've got this part of the show where we call it Hack of the Week. It's a lot harder for me because I have to come up with a new one of these every week, and the guest always looks incredible because you've just got one. So we're going to do that again this week, and you can blow me out of the water. Can you share an AI tool or use case in AI that you try, you've tried recently and you love that the listeners might benefit from?
More of a workflow that I like doing. So I'm big on data. Yeah, love data. We've got dashboards all around the office, like everything in our business. We've got that all sits in data warehouse, which inherently means you've got to use, SQL or something to interact with it. And I'm absolutely woeful of that. I'm completely hopeless. But what I do in, ChatGPT, Claude, any of the sort of interfaces, I just dump all the database structures and I tell it what I'm trying to achieve, and it writes like thousands and thousands of lines of SQL, and it's amazing. And it's a bit of a running joke in the office. So
that is awesome, though.
I can write a weapon. Well, no, it might not even be a good query. Someone probably looking at me like, what absolutely is this thing? But I can show you.
But you get the outcome?
Yeah.
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 We were forced to do SQL at uni for Masters of Commerce with data analytics in it. And it already felt so archaic 2 years ago. So I think that that's a great hack. Like, why would you be learning SQL at this point, right? It seems kind of a waste of the skill set.
I don't even read what the errors are. I just like paste in back what the errors are. I'm just so lazy with it. But it nails.
If it can do it. Mine is kind of hacky as well. I've been using ChatGPT to come up with learning courses for me. And actually, I've been using it as of the last 2 days to write gym workouts for me as well. And I sent it to a friend who has had like a million hours of personal training. And she's like, I actually back this. I wouldn't pay for a personal trainer to use it. So in terms of learning courses, I've been asking it for AI specific courses, getting the difference between tokenization and embedding versus like when tokenization, is it using a subword or the history of it where they used to use a whole word and all of that stuff I'm getting through asking ChatGPT to teach me a learning course.
As well as your Hack of the Week suggestions.
Yeah, I should use it for Hack of the Week because these are weirdly specific. I want to have a gym workout routine that exclusively uses handheld weights. It's pretty cool for that.
For my legs.
for my ankles. All right, I've called this section Drone King. How do you feel about being the Drone King?
I probably deserve to be in a mausoleum or something. I'm more like the old grandpa.
He's
maybe
loving
I'm like
it.
Dirty grandpa, dirty drone grandpa.
Yeah, I could have been way meaner. Drone King.
I've got so many grey hairs these days.
Well, it's because you're a ripe old age of 32. But seriously, you have been in business for long enough that I'm not surprised you've got a few. Profitable business at 15 and then, you know, VC-backed, AI-enabled startup. What are some of the misconceptions that you have around drones now that you're at that stage, though? You talked about, you know, hobby drones. You've talked about, you know, them used in your past. But now that you're building a scaled VC-backed company, is it so much about drones or a bigger picture? And what are we getting wrong there?
Yeah, and answer the question in sort of both parts. Like it's never, in a commercial sense, it's never about the drones. So, you know, why does someone buy a drone? They need photography. They need to be able to do something with it, or they need delivery, or, you know, they need space in the drone to do something. But no one, unless you're a hobbyist, you don't buy a drone just for fun. And that will wear off very quickly. It can only do so many things. You know, it's up and down, left and right. It's like, okay, well, there's not much else to it. And that's sort of, you know, the utilization of drones to achieve something is where, if you look at Ascendia and what we're doing today, we're an asset management solution around, you know, sort of predicting, planning, and operating property assets at scale. And it's much like drone delivery. You know, it has a space in a courier framework potentially, but realistically, people are going to use trucks to do this sort of stuff as well. You know, no one's just going to use a drone to deliver everything in the world. And so for us, drones play a part in our product. And certainly, you know, across sort of Australia and the US, we've probably got 5,000 or 6,000 pilots in our network now, but it's a very hyper-localized model where this data goes out and gets collected and comes back in. And then it, you know, is a source for us to do a bunch of other stuff in the product itself. And so that's really where I think once the drone is flowing, that's where everything starts, rather than, you know, some people sort of view that as like job done, but that's just an enablement of a much bigger picture.
And the bigger picture in asset management, so those listening at home, Ascendia Asset Management, why was this an area that you thought was particularly compelling, especially after years working in drones and the space? Why were you like, that's where it needs to be disrupted?
In our drone business, and we still have a drone business in the Ascendia business as well, sort of sits in there. And we were basically making PDF reports for people, and they would get a PDF, it was like digital PDF reports, the easiest way to explain. And they'd sort of print that off and do their thing with it. And they'd pay us a lot of money for it, but they never use it again. And so it was like, okay, well, there's actually a lot of value to this data. You know, an asset lives and breathes in its environment. It's like a person. If you put a person outside for 50 years and did nothing with them, they'd be looking pretty weathered as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the same with an asset. It's like, okay, each of these assets has its own independent, like, little personality. And how can we use data to better understand these assets? You know, how they are now and how they live and breathe in the environment they're in effectively. And that's really what Ascendia is about. Delivering for customers at scale, the ability to manage asset networks. So it might be 10 or 20 warehouses here in Australia, or it could be a few thousand sites in the US.
Mm-hmm.
You know, across areas is a massive scope, and each of them has the same challenge of, you know, their assets degrade, you know, and that's essentially what it is. It's like, how can we slow down asset degradation, or how can we make it cheaper to manage degrading assets? And that's really like the trade-off at the end of the day. And that's what we're trying to build with Ascendia.
It's huge, right? Like, one of my first jobs out of uni, I had a chemical engineering degree, and the options were in very crumbling down manufacturing sites everywhere, I can assure you. But it's true that stuff matters. Like, if we're working with equipment and machinery that's been out in the Brisbane sun for 30 years, it just has efficiency issues. And I can see, like, firsthand how much that impacted the final product in terms of what we were doing in a food manufacturing plant. You guys use high-quality imagery to help with that conversation with your clients and machine learning. Can you tell me a little bit more about that conversation and how exactly you use that imagery to help them?
Yeah, and that's sort of where I guess part of the drones come in. So in a drone sense, we would fly a drone over somebody's site, collect a few thousand images, that process, those images are reconstructed to 3D through a process called photogrammetry. And then that generates a really high resolution 3D model, essentially. So off that, that's when we do a range of sort of AI layers around defects and componentization. So breaking the asset down into like how many anchor points or how many fans or these sort of things across the asset network, which sounds super unsexy, but if you've got like 1,000 warehouses or something, you don't actually know, you know, what you've got. And then from there, there's a range of other sort of solutions in the product around using data, you know, to do various things. The platform's expanding a lot more as well to provide essentially like an end-to-end solution for people who own assets. We obviously put data into it at the moment, but more and more it's around the workflows of, you know, managing condition and degradation in these assets. Yeah, lots of exciting things sort of happening there. We launched an expansion of the product earlier this year, Asset OS, which, much like it sounds, an operating system for asset owners. So it, you know, it just does more and more, I guess, of trying to own the workflow for the customer and help them, you know, help them own what they need to.
Yeah, and you say unsexy probably because you've done this so many times too that it's, you know, another day in the life. But if I knew that there was a drone coming to my site and it was going to take all these pictures, I would be excited. I would be quite pumped. Do you have people like looking out the window at the drone in all the pictures?
There's certainly some characters. You know, we've got hundreds of millions of images now, but yeah, they've been across all sorts of sizes, like, you know, really remote warehouses, prisons, you know, school.
Wow.
There's everything, like anything you can think of has been photographed, and there'd probably be, I don't know, 150,000 buildings, maybe 200,000 buildings in the system now that are in the platform that, you know, actively manage. And so, yeah, we've seen most of it. Even had things, yeah, people throw things at it. And,
really?
Yeah.
And you've got an AI engineer that goes really deep into the weeds. But just for the listeners, what is his role specifically once you've got those images?
Yeah, so the AI, we sort of think of AI in two ways in the system. One's like helping us get to our data outputs faster, which is more like an internal enablement thing. And then the second one's around like workflow, more like agentic style AI. But in the workflow or in the sort of background processes, yeah, we run sort of dozens of like microservices or models essentially that are generating things like what's the amount of membrane roofing on this site, or how much color bond roofing, you know, is on this specific asset, or how many skylights, these sort of things. So each of them is specific to each sort of region and use case, but it's really about building up, yeah, an asset hierarchy on the site and a defect register. So telling people they've got 200 instances of corrosion on this asset that need to be fixed, and these are the priority of the top five of them, or, you know, trim these trees because you've got guttering. And it's an evolving, you know, it's constantly evolving over time, that, particularly as we're going to new regions and things. And so, yeah, a lot of, I guess, process and enablement in the back end.
And as a business owner and, you know, having an AI company, compute is probably a big part of what your capital costs go towards. How do you as a founder consider where to focus on improvement and where you're happy to spend the money versus where you're like, that is just not helping our customers and our end product and we can cut that out?
Compute it's an expensive piece, that's for sure. Particularly because in the drone imagery piece and other aerial imagery, 3D reconstruction uses a similar amount of like heavy graphics compute. So we would run dozens and dozens of servers for that. But yeah, I guess it's trade-off of like what directly impacts the customer, what's working. Like for us at our growth stage, yes, you know, there's definitely some more stuff that could be automated or processes put in differently, but we are focused on building a product for the end customer. It's like, okay, we can let this burn for the next 12 months in this process, but we know it's going to be completely removed anyway, you know, in a future iteration of the product, we're going to change something. It's like, okay, well, then we sort of deprioritize that. And yeah, then just a ton of sort of intensity around people like focus on what needs to get done. And generally that we wouldn't work on like a novel use case, I'd say. For us, where we sit in the asset management space, our solution, you know, is sort of incredibly unique, but I wouldn't say we're at absolutely the bleeding edge of AI innovation, which is positive for us because we can sort of pick and choose, and rarely does AI solve one problem for us. So like in our series of 10 or 15 things in a process, we might put some things in there with AI, might, some other just general automation, some other computer, just like general processing stuff. And so, yeah, it's I'm sure it's something in time that we'll have a ton of sort of legacy issues with.
Like every company ever. I remember when I was working at Ford, they had like this mainframe of like 1980s, like black screen, green tech stuff, just because it was a legacy product that we couldn't upgrade because it had too many moving parts in the supply chain. You have reminded me of a chat we had once before. You guys are an AI company that leverages AI, but you said, your customers... Like, it's not a brand thing that you guys use AI, like some startups out there that are like, we're an AI company. Because your customers, you told me that some of them aren't even on the internet. Like, it's not a branding strategy to push that down people's throats. How do you talk to your customers when you are a very technical company and they probably don't really care whether you leverage AI or not?
Yeah, I think it's sort of, it's telling... Depends who you sell to, but for us, like telling a customer you use AI is like telling them our website's built on a specific language. Like really, it's
JavaScript.
How do we help them get to their output quicker? So like in the terms of asset management, as soon as that insight, is detected but not presented, it starts to decay in its value. So if it takes you an hour, a day, a week, a month, whatever to get it out, then all of a sudden the value of that insight is significantly reduced. And so it's like, how can you provide a real-time, sort of insight for the customer? That's really that drives a lot of our design. And then how can we help them complete a workflow? So AI, is integral in all this sort of stuff, but it's not all AI enabled XYZ, because sometimes they don't even know what the XYZ is anyway. They know they've got it, but they also only do that because... that's how someone who sent them an Excel spreadsheet has done it in the past. And so that's for us is like, how can we help them get to the insight quicker, and how can we close the loop for them? And if we can do those two things, in parallel, then we make their life better and faster for that, make their job faster. And that's core to our success. Whether we roll out 10 or 100 users of AI in our marketing over the next year, reality is no one's probably going to care. And if they do care, they're probably not the decision maker realistically.
I see. And, whenever you say workflow for asset management, tumbleweed goes through my brain because I have no idea what that looks like. What is a workflow for an asset manager, and where is a common bottleneck in the workflow that you guys are like, we could sort that out?
So there's a ton of just process-based stuff. So in what we do in a city, defect register as an example. In previously, we were just part of the problem then. We just generate these defect registers and everyone's like, great, what do I do with it? Like, this is amazing. But now I just have a ton of defects I don't know what to do with. And so that would usually go into a third-party system, like an ERP or an enterprise asset management system, that they would create a work order, and then they would assign it to a vendor, and then they'd monitor that vendor to make sure the work got done, then they'd close that out. For us, a workflow is that whole thing. So in terms of it, it's like, how can, whether we create the defect or somebody else does, how can we then feed it into an ERP or a system like that? How can we then take that data out, assign the vendor, assign any reworks on the work order that are required, close that out, update the asset register that's been replaced. So in 12 months, when you do an asset audit or something like that, it's not, oh, we've now got two air conditioning units that we don't know which one's right. It's like, okay, well, that one got replaced. This is the new one. And that workflow piece, like in asset management particularly and facilities management, people spend 30, 40% of their time just like manually doing things, manually writing work orders, talking to vendors, pulling data out in CSV format to merge it. It's just an absolute chaos of a process.
And I'm guessing not very, it would be all like work order numbers and equipment numbers and just like a sea of numbers that, like, I guess it would be easy to have human error if you're doing it in that way, right?
Yeah, people just don't, in a lot of these legacy systems like ERPs and stuff, they're really powerful systems, but the information that sits in them is typically woeful. And therefore, everything that is in the system is usually woeful because it's just human entered data. That's just like, someone's like, oh, I know I've got to put this field in, but I skip it every time because this is how I skip it. It's like, okay, well, that's like a required field for a specific reason. And then someone's
probably
running.
Probably shouldn't.
And so with a lot of these legacy systems and processes, it's rather than, you know, for us, it's not about trying to replace any of that. It's how can we actually make those effectively modern day systems and this process and modern day workflow to actually make asset management operate in the way it should in 2025.
Yeah. Another thing that floats into my brain, the mining industry, is that a compelling customer for you? I know a lot of your customers are US based, but I'm thinking of, you know, if you're an oil and gas company and your equipment is a safety risk if it isn't maintained effectively. Long way around saying, are there certain customers that are more compelling for you and it's an easy sell or not?
Yeah, so we wouldn't typically push into mining or oil and gas. We wouldn't typically say push into oil and gas. Mining we do a bit in, but for them, they've got so much money to make sure something doesn't go wrong. That, you know, of course, they're budget constrained, but realistically, there's a significant
pool of money there. They will allocate.
Yeah, whereas for us, we're very much about distributed, you know, networks. For a customer to sort of feel the pain that a SETI solves for them, it's best if they've got lots of locations, you know, or they've got either a massive site or they've got tons of locations. And that's why large format real estate typically is benefit or is a sort of benefits from the system, industrial, retail, government property, these sort of things. So I could tell you what most warehouses look like, but where all your sort of goods get shipped from in the US and Australia, I've seen pretty much all of those, but not...
I bet.
Yeah, not necessarily the houses or those sort of things. And it's like, yeah, you got to feel the impact at scale. So if you've got a roof that, you know, might be 9 or 12 football fields, like that is, and you say, oh, I'm going to send someone on the roof to look at it. If you send someone out to look over just one football field, they're not even going to find everything that's on there. You know, that is just not going to happen. And in the US particularly, in Australia, but the US, it's really hot in summer, you know, and in Arizona, like these roofs, as an example, are just like crazy hot. And so, you can't even put people on them for parts of the year, or they don't really want to spend extended amounts of time up there when they do go.
Yeah, and the safety element and all of that. Are you going to do all of OpenAI and Microsoft and whatever the hell's data centers that they're building? Is that on your go-to list of outreach?
Data centers certainly an interesting, you know, space for us, and a lot happening there. I think the funny part, I guess, seeing in these industries as they move and change, and we're involved in a lot of probably the early enablement work for sites too, just generally. And so this big explosion of data centers that has occurred. This land was acquired years and years ago. You know, it's been the pipeline for ages. They're investing in it now, but a lot of this has been in play for quite a significant amount of time. And so, yeah, it's interesting seeing customers and they're expanding sort of networks, particularly in the US, you know, a lot of investment in data centers.
It's funny you say that. I remember when there was the announcement earlier this year about the OpenAI data centers and the, you know, the growth of that and how much money was being spent. But apparently it was like a Biden administration thing that was approved initially. Like, as you say, it's not like Trump was signing it off very publicly, but it wasn't actually about him or anything to do with recent political movement.
Yeah, we've some of those sites that, you know, would sit in a city have been in there for years. You know,
really?
Friday monitoring done on them when they were greenfield sites or something like that. So, yeah, we're across a range of customers who have exposure to data centers and industrial and those sort of things.
Are you a bit jealous of the founders that when they go see customers, it's in like Paris and Rome and you're like deep Arizona in summer?
No, I see some, I think probably the most authentic parts of the world. We get around. It was funny. We're in Dallas for a trip. I'd go to Dallas a bit, and we went to visit customer, you know, a bit out of town, and I didn't think we'd be getting out to get an Uber that day. So I hired a car and wasn't too sure what I hired, and this blacked out Lexus turns up, and when we turned up to the customer, it looked like we were repossessing the place, honestly. Like, we hopped out.
Are you wearing a suit?
You gotta wear a suit that
day. Had a clipboard?
Honestly, it was like, who are these absolute tossers who just turned up?
Oh, now you got VC investment. You think you can get a limo?
Well, it was cheaper than an Uber would have been, but it was funny. Once it turned up, I was like, oh, this is like...
They already hate us.
Funny. Like 2 or 3 hours into rural Texas from Dallas, and there we are, just... Yeah.
You got a print out of your Forbes 30 under 30.
It was...
That was quite funny.
Yeah. That's classic. Okay, I would love to have your expert opinion to help me unpack a few headlines. It's a section I've never done on the show before, but you're a good sport, Angus, so I figured let's give it a go. It's called Lame or Lucrative. I'm going to share some drone-related headlines, and I want your hot take. Are you excited?
Oh, absolutely. Nothing more excites me than this.
Your eyes have lit up.
Let's go. Let's see if I'm going to annoy the industry. Let's go.
You're like, they're all lame. Next. Okay, there's an Irish drone supply chain startup called Manna. They managed to raise $30 million delivering things like coffees to residential homes. Is this lame or lucrative, Angus?
I would say that's lame. I think you got to deliver a lot of coffees to win there. And yeah, there's a lot happening. There's been a lot of promise, but I don't think the future in drone deliveries is as glorious as is potentially made out, at least in the near term.
Yeah, and just because I'm curious, is the, like, it feels like the drone is so expensive and the coffee is so cheap, and like, is human labor just cheaper than a drone to operate and service and do stuff like that? Or,
you know, drone delivery, there's a big thing at the moment, which is like, how do you integrate drones into manned airspace? And that's actually where I think the game is won, is if you can control who flies, not who, if you can control who gets the coffee from A to B, but you're not the person who gets it from A to B, you win in the industry. And that's the bit that with drone deliveries is still fairly open right now. There's a single global provider for, you know, manned aircraft, like flight aircraft information, essentially, like air traffic control. And in drones, it's a similar thing, which, you know, Google, their investment in Wing, which I think we'd spoken about before, I think that's where Google wins. Google's not interested because they can make $2 on a coffee. Yeah, Google's interested because there's a $1 billion data sort of play there. And the data play is around drones, you know, and the management of that drone fleet, in inverted commas.
You did tell me about Wing, because that was going to be my next lame or lucrative. So thanks, Angus. Ruin that one. Let's tell the listeners. It is a Alphabet or Google subsidiary that delivers groceries, food, and more. But it's the big tech incumbent. And you think this is lucrative because they own the airspace. Like, they own the ability to provide that service. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so I think Wing's drone delivery service is lame. I think Google's play at drone delivery is lucrative. So, you know, Wing has a bunch of data products that they and platforms that they're building, much like the Google, you know, solution generally is. And they've done hundreds of thousands of flights. And their IP that they're building is the ability to get a drone from A to B in congested manned airspace, not the ability to get your coffee from A to B. And that's is really what the big learning is there. You know, they're not, truly my view, but I don't believe they're interested in it because they reckon they can monetize the...
They can upsell that oat versus skim milk, Angus.
You see how they've changed. So, like, it started off down in Canberra, then it went up to Queensland, to Logan from memory, and sort of gradually been increasing the density of where they're allowed to operate. Like, when it first started in Australia, I think it was in Bungendore or something down outside Canberra, which is like, no one was getting anything delivered there, but it was a good use case. They're able to show their regulator. Then they've gradually become more, sort of built up through more congested airspace. And the way manned airspace, or the way airspace is assessed at the moment, general and regulatory sense, is like manned airspace is the priority. But Boeing and Airbus have sort of, in their view, generated their last sort of edition or last version of piloted aircraft, you know, primarily piloted aircraft. And so, in the next 5, 10, 15 years, we will see a switch to airspace being primarily unmanned priority, including, you know, aircraft that move people around the world. And at the point that happens, whoever controls that is an enormous opportunity.
Wow. Genuinely very fascinating.
That's a really flawed answer to lame or lucrative.
No, I loved it. I loved it. My last one, though, is a bit left of field. maybe a little bit outside of your sphere of interest, but flying cars, it's still manned airspace, Angus. There's this company, Klein's Vision Aircar, prepares to take flight commercially in 2026. This revolutionary vehicle promises to transform our daily commutes. So we're rising above traffic congestion, Angus. No longer do we have to get on the highways to go from Sydney to the Southern Highlands, and we're going to be in flying cars. Lame or lucrative?
I think that's lame.
Tell us what you really think.
I think...
Beep, beep.
I don't think much is going to happen there, to be honest. We thought, you know, flying cars are going to be a flight, you know, drones, manned drones are going to be a thing that existed 10 years ago, but... I'd rather buy a manned helicopter or something. It's just something really satisfying around like the sound of an engine. Whereas, you know, I think in a drone, a flying drone, like if those engines were to stop, that would be a very quiet experience.
Creepy, right? You don't see a world where we're living like the Jetsons then?
I think we're a long way off that, but I'm really happy to be proven wrong and that it's an extraordinarily amazing, you know, implementation and sort of industry expansion over the next few years. If that's what I get wrong, so be it. I'm more than happy to.
Let's stick to the Waymos for the short term, hey? You have been such a great sport. We are going to finish the episode with our rapid fire round. So, kind of spicier questions. You can handle it, though.
Habit.
We've warmed up, right? What makes an incredible VC? A true partner while you're building your company, or someone that gives you money and then leaves you alone, Angus?
For our stage, partner. You know, we got an amazing VC in Tidal. Don't tell them that. But we love working with them, and we have very sort of strong execution skills, but some, you know, areas where we need sort of positive, significant contribution for our VC. And so I'd say, yeah, partner for us at this stage.
That's awesome. Anything in particular that you think you should shop around for VCs for any other founders listening?
Still a character reference, you know, get them checked. But also don't raise, like don't go to market when you need the money. For example, Tidal, when they joined our cap table, I think we spoke for them for, you know, 9 or 10 months. And by the time we sort of, you know, got through to a term sheet and things, then we demonstrated some stuff. They demonstrated they could work with us and add value there as well. And yeah, it's been an amazing experience so far with them. Doesn't mean everyone agrees all the time. And in fact, you know, that'd be bad if they did. But we are incredibly well supported and sort of on our way, which is a positive thing.
Yes, so supportive, in fact, that Kieran from Tidal, I think, has a big cardboard cutout of you in his house. So, that's what you want to see.
It's on my desk now. But I was on a meeting when he first brought it over. It sits behind a cupboard, actually, but I had it behind me and I didn't realize it. About halfway through, I just saw me there. I was like, oh, I was with some people in the US. I was like, oh, my God. I look like an
the absolute biggest wanker.
Yeah, like don't that. Like, let's put blur on.
Oh my gosh, they would have thought you got that printed out. For the listeners, that happened because Angus was part of the AI accelerator at Google and it was printed out on demo day. But now it looks like you did that.
Particularly by the third or fourth meeting where I kept it there. But no, it was probably put beside the cupboard then behind my desk.
Oh, that's the best thing I've ever heard. I remember seeing Kieran walk out of the building with it. It was like I got so many photos, nothing's been funnier.
I think he bought, so their office is a couple of K's and a K from ours here. I think he just walked through the Sydney CBD with that and that up there. But he's never had so many compliments in his life. So, clearly he
peaked that day. Yeah. You guys are a beautiful, beautiful partnership. Snog, marry or avoid? No, snog, marry, avoid. You've got to pick one of each for Google, Microsoft, AWS.
Ooh, I will pass this question because we are multi-cloud and all three support us in various ways. Don't bite the hand that feeds you.
I marry them all. Look, fair enough. We don't want to get you cancelled. How about I switch this one out? Snog, marry, avoid, Jeff Bezos. Sun Shun Piksha. No, I'm kidding.
Snog them all.
Snog them all. Get cardboard cutouts of them all. Did you watch Google I.O. this year? Yeah, can recommend. kind of cool.
I'll be sure to jump on and have a look.
Yeah, yeah, I'll send you a link. Don't you worry. If you got Jeff Bezos' level of wealth, would you quit tomorrow and chill out on an island somewhere, or would you keep grinding away?
I love working. I don't work for money. I think that's risky when people do, but I love working. I love, you know, solving the problems we do. I'd probably buy more farmland or something, buy a bigger farm, or I don't know. That'd be my thing, I imagine. But no, I wouldn't stop working. I really like.
Yeah. I do get that sense that you genuinely love what you do. Any aspect of your life where you actually prefer form over function? Because you have told me in the past that you're very into function over form as a business standpoint.
I'm big on utility. So if it doesn't provide utility, then...
Your poor wife, she must really struggle.
I do love a nice car. So okay. That's looking at them. I won't buy one. Cars are lovely. No, I think like I'm all about utility. If it doesn't provide, you know, sort of functional or utility for us in a business or sort of otherwise, then yeah. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe with kids or something, but they're sort of isolated, they're separate. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and the last question. Who do you admire most in the Australian tech/startup ecosystem? Who would you shout out to?
That is an interesting one. I don't know if there'd be a specific person per se, but I really appreciate the journey that companies in an enterprise or sort of like B2B sense have gone through in similarly unsexy spaces as us. So, you know, the sort of journey that Safety Culture or Employment Hero or a company like that has been on, where there's just a lot of grinding, but also very sort of specific domain understanding around what the solution is. You know, for us, we're not trying to build a solution that we don't know the industry. Like, we have an intimate understanding of the industry, what we're trying to deliver. It doesn't make it easy. And so, yeah, I appreciate any of those, like, I mean, grinding it out in like a hustle sense, but I mean, just like year after year of building this solution with a laser focus on where that sort of business needs to be.
Absolutely amazing, Angus. This was so fun. I learned so much genuinely about drones, which kind of VCs to like partner with, what's lame and lucrative in the airspace category. You've been such a great guest. Thank you so much. Before we close out, is there anything you'd like to shout out to listeners? How do they find out more about Aseti, more about you? Where do they subscribe? What do they do?
If you want to find out more about what we're doing at Aseti, it's just aseti.com, aseti.com.
Hey, those YouTube watchers.
aseti.com, yeah, we're sort of transforming the way people manage assets. And if you know anyone who has a distributed asset network or has challenges with their assets, hit us up. But yeah. Sort of, we sit in the part of the world that you probably don't even think about usually, which is sometimes the most important part of the world. There you go.
And if anyone wants to see baby Angus on Forbes, go to Forbes 30 under 30, Angus Stevens. It's an adorable photo. Thanks so much, Angus. Bye.
Thanks, Georgie. Bye.
Thank you for listening to In the Blink of AI. You can check out the show notes for anything discussed in this week's episode, and we will be back next week. This podcast was produced by Day One, with music by Dan Hansen and visual artwork by Sophie Tyrell. If you loved the episode, please tell your mates, and I love AI news. Please share your thoughts and suggestions to GeorginaRoseHealy@gmail.com.